Bark played fast on a woodwind. With a burst of sensation across Rana's skin, the rasp of talons, coherence arrived. Rana had been trained to give the results of her brain bugs quickly, spitting out the essential data before they had time to escape her mind's tenuous grasp. And the rush of knowledge was so sharp and clear, so shocking this time, that she couldn't stop herself. "You're a Rix, aren't you?" she blurted. "The compound mind's talking through you. You want to..." Rana Harta bit her tongue, cursing her stupidity. The woman remained still for a moment, as if waiting for a translation. Rana's eyes darted around the room, casting for a weapon, but there was nothing at hand that could stop the sudden bird-like alien across from her, not for a second. Then Rana saw the emergency pull cord swinging above her head. She reached up for it, yanking down hard on the elegant brass handle, cool in her hand. She braced herself for the screech of brakes, the wail of a siren. Nothing happened. Rana fell back into her seat. The compound mind, her own brain told her. Everywhere. "You want to impersonate me?" Rana found herself compelled to finish. "Yes," the Rix woman said. "Yes," repeated Rana. She felt, with a strange relief after trying so hard not to all day long, that she would cry. Then the alien woman leaned forward, one fingertip extended and glistening, and with a touch, thrust a needle into Rana's arm. One moment of pain, and after that, everything was just fine. Captain. The haze of points that represented the Rix battlecruiser and her satellites grew more diffuse as the minutes passed. The smaller cloud that was the Lynx changed too, softening, as if Captain Zai's eyes were losing focus. He blinked reflexively, but the airscreen image of the approaching hosts continued to blur. The two combatant ships deployed still more adjunct craft, hundreds of drones to provide intelligence to penetrate and attack the other ship, and to harry the opponent's drones. The Lynx and the Rix ship became two stately clouds nearing a slow collision. "Freeze!" Zai ordered. The two clouds stopped, just touching. "What's the relative velocity at the edge?" he asked his executive officer. 1% light speed," Hobbs answered. Someone on the command bridge let out an audible rush of breath. 3,000 clicks per second," Master Pilot Marks translated, muttering to himself. Zai let the cold fact of this velocity sink in, then resumed the simulation. The clouds drifted into each other, the movement just visible, seemingly no faster than the setting sun as it approaches the horizon. Of course, only the grand scale of the battle made the pace look glacial. At the scale of the invisibly small craft within those point clouds, the fight would unfold at a terrific pace. The Lynx's captain drummed his fingers. His ship was designed for combat at much lower relative velocities. In a normal intercept situation, he would accelerate alongside the battlecruiser, matching its vector. Standard tactics against larger craft demanded minimal relative motion to give the Imperial drone swarm sufficient time to wear down the bigger ship's defenses. Even against Rix cyborgs, Imperial pilots were renowned, and the Lynx, as the prototype of its class, had been allotted some of the best in the Navy. But Zai didn't have the luxury of standard tactics. He had a mission to carry out. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 6. The Risen Empire by Scott Westerfeld. Continuing on page 222. Master Pilot Marks was the first to speak up. "There won't be much piloting to it, sir," he said. "Even our fastest drones only make 1,000 G's acceleration. That's 10,000 meters per second squared. 1% of the constant equals 3 million meters per second. We'll be rushing past them too fast to do any dogfighting." Marks glared into the airscreen. "There won't be much we can do to protect the Lynx from their penetrators either, Captain," he concluded.
"That won't be your job, Master Pilot," Zai said. "Just keep your drones intact and get them through to attack the Rix ship."
The Master Pilot nodded. His role in this, at least, was clear. Zai let the simulation run further. As Marks had complained, the crashing waves of drones had little effect on one another. They were passing through each other too quickly for any but the luckiest of shots to hit. Soon, the outermost edges of the two spheres reached each other's vital centers. The Lynx and the Rix battlecruiser began to take damage. The kinetic hits of flechettes and expansion webs, wide-area radiation strikes from energy weapons. "Freeze!" Sai ordered. "You'll notice that the adjunct craft have started making hits," Exo Hobbs took up the narrative.
"A ship's a much bigger target than a 2-meter drone," Marks said.
"Exactly," Hobbs said, "and a battlecruiser is a bigger target than a frigate, especially this particular battlecruiser." She zoomed the view into the bright moat that was the Rick's vessel. The receiver array became visible, the ship proper no more than a speck against its vast expanse. Hobbs added a scale marker. The array was 1,000 kilometers across.
"Think you can hit that?" Hobbs asked.
Master Pilot Marks nodded slowly.
"Absolutely, Executive Officer. Provided I'm still alive."
Zai nodded. Marks had a point. He would be piloting remotely from the belly of the Lynx, which would itself be under attack. The Imperial ship had to survive long enough for its drones to reach the Rick's battlecruiser.
"We'll be alive. The Lynx will be inside a tight group of close-in-defense drones. We'll railgun them out in front, then have them cut back to match the velocity of the incoming drones," Hobbs said.
"Or as close as they can get," Marks corrected her. "The Lynx's defensive drones could never match the incoming Rick's attackers at 3,000 clicks a second."
"And we'll be clearing our path with all the abrasion sand we can produce," Hobbs sighed.
"But we'll have our hands full," she finished. Zai was glad to hear the nervous tremor just audible in her voice. This plan was a dangerous one. The staff had to understand that.
"May I ask a question, Captain?"
It was Second Gunner Thompson.
"Gunner?"
Zai said.
"This collision of a battle plan," he said slowly, "is it designed to protect Legis or to create a tactical advantage for the Lynx?"
"Both," Zai answered. "Our orders are to prevent contact between the battlecruiser and the compound mind." Zai's fingers moved and the view pulled back to a schematic of the entire system. It filled with the vectors he and Hobbs had worked out that afternoon.
"To make it work, we'll have to accelerate spinward, out toward the battlecruiser, then turn over and come back in. Over the next 10 days, we'll have to average 10 G's.
The command bridge stirred. Zai and his crew would be spending the next week suffering under the uneasy protection of easy gravity. Uncomfortable and dangerous, the high G conditions would leave them exhausted for the battle.
"And yes," Zai continued, "as Gunner Thompson suggests, high relative velocity gives us a tactical advantage, given our orders. Our objective is not to engage the Rick's battlecruiser in a fight to the death. We're to destroy its array as quickly as possible."
"Suicide missions thrive on high velocities," Thompson quoted.
"The bastard," Zai thought, to cite Anonymous 167 at him as if this situation were of Zai's devising.
"We're under orders, Gunner," Hobbs snapped. "Preventing contact between the Rick's battlecruiser and the Legis compound mind is our primary objective."
She left the rest unspoken. The Lynx's survival was of secondary concern. Thompson shrugged, not meeting Hobbs's eye. He was one of those more intimidated by her beauty than her rank.
"Why can't they just pull the plug on the mind down on Legis?" he managed.
Zai sighed. He didn't want his crew spending its energy this way, trying to think of ways to get out of the coming battle.
"They wouldn't have to give up technology forever," Thompson continued, "just for a few days while the battlecruiser passed by. In boot camp, I lived in a simulated jungle biome for a month using traditional survival techniques. We could offer assistance from Lynx for any emergencies."
"This is a planet, Thompson," Hobbs explained, "not some Navy training biome. 2 billion civilians and the entire infrastructure that necessitates. Every day that's 10 billion gallons of liters, 2 million tons of food produced and distributed, and 500,000 emergency medical responses. All of it dependent on the infrastructure. Dependent, in effect, on the Rick's compound mind."
"We'd have to somehow disable every piece of technology for 4 days, Zai continued. "On a planet of Legis's population, there will be 200,000 births in that time. Care to use your survival skills to assist with them all, Thompson?"
The command bridge filled with laughter.
"No, sir," the man answered. "Not covered in my basic training, sir."
"How unfortunate," Zai concluded.
"Then I'll want your detailed analyses of the current attack plan by 200. We'll be under high gravities by 400. One last night of decent sleep for the crew."
"Dismissed," Hobbs said.
The bridge bustled with energy as the senior officers went to present the plan to their own staffs. Hobbs gave her captain a supporting nod. Zai was pleased she'd been able to defuse the trouble that second gunner Thompson had started. Attacking the superior Rick's ship would be an easier sacrifice if the crew thought of it in terms of how many lives they were saving down below. But why was Thompson confronting him in front of his staff? The second gunner was from an old gray family with as solid a military tradition as the Zais. By some measures, Thompson was grayer than his captain. One of his brothers was an aspirant in the apparatus. None of the Zais had ever been politicals. Perhaps Thompson's words were intended to remind Zai that the imperial pardon was a sham, a way for the Emperor to save face. But it was a graceless pardon, paired with an impossible task which might yet destroy him, his ship, and his crew. Clearly, Laurent Zai had not been forgiven. Commando. Wielding the monofilament knife carefully, Hurd cut Rana Harta's long hair down to a few centimeters. The dopamine regulators that the commando had injected into her captive's bloodstream were self-perpetuating. The woman would remain acquiescent for days. As the medical records Hurd had unearthed at the library had shown, Harta suffered from chronic low-level depression. Any decent society would have cured it as a matter of course. But the Empire found Rana's synesthetic disorder, her savant mathematical ability, useful. Imperial medicine wasn't sophisticated enough to both heal Harta and maintain the delicate balance of her brain bug, so they let her suffer. For the Ricks, however, the treatment was child's play. Harta was still feeling some side effects. Her attention seemed to wander now and then, lapsing into short fugues of inactivity, her eyelids shuddering a bit. But when shown the colonel's badge, she followed orders. The Imperials conditioned their subjects well. Hurd set Harta to organizing the strands of her shorn hair by length on the cabin's ornate table, while the commando shaved her own head down to the scalp. The handheld monitor pinged, an order from the compound mind. A schematic on its screen showed the location of the train's medical station. Leaving Rana Harta humming as she worked, the Rix commando braved the corridors of the train again. Having seen no bald women on Legis, Hurd covered her head with the hood of her uniform. She knew that clothing, grooming, and other bodily markers were used to project status and political affiliation even outside the military hierarchy of the Empire. A hairless head might draw attention. How odd. These un-Rix humans rejected upgrade, but they still played games with dead cells and bits of cloth and string. The medical station sprang to life as she entered, its red eyes projecting a lattice of lasers across the newly bald planes of her head. A few seconds after these measurements were taken, the station delivered two needles of specially programmed nanos and another set of orders. The map led to the maglev train's storage hold. Hurd easily wrenched open the lock there and liberated a tube of repair smart plastic and another of petroleum jelly. Back in the cabin, she doped the smart plastic with one of the needles and squeezed it onto the neat pile of Rana Harta's shorn hair. The nanoed plastic writhed for a few minutes, giving off noticeable heat in the small cabin. The mass sent out thin threads that wove themselves among the hair cuttings. These wispy filaments spread out, consuming the mound of repair plastic and creating a spiderweb that covered the entire table. For a while, the web undulated slowly as if cataloging, planning. Then its motion quickened. The whole mass contracted into a solid dome, a milky hemisphere into which the hairs were drawn. The surface of the plastic seethed with the ends of Rana Harta's red hair, which protruded and dove back into the mound as if ghostly fingers inside were knitting them according to some complex design. It soothed the commando's mind to watch the elegant and miniature process unfold. Here in the crowded train, she was far too aware of the gross, un-Rix mass of humanity that surrounded her. She could smell them, hear the phatic chatter of their mouths, feel their handiwork in the bulbous curves and plush textures of this supposedly luxurious cabin, informed by the extravagant concept of privacy. The Rick spacecraft and orbitals that had always been her home were Spartan and pure, joyful with the clean lines of functionality, the efficiency of intimately shared spaces, the evident perfection of compound mind design. These un-Rix humans sought joy in waste, ornamentation, excess. Hurd knew, of course, that this society's disorder was a necessary evil. The messy inefficiencies of humanity underlay true AI. Alexander emerged from the electronic clutter of this planet, much as Hurd's own thoughts arose from an inefficient tangle of nervous tissue.
But she was Rick's and had been raised to see the whole. To be trapped among the horde that underlay Alexander was like descending from the sublime visions of an art museum into the rank smells of an oil paint factory. The Rick's woman tore her eyes from the graceful programmed movements of the plastic and got back to work. She ordered Rana Harter to strip. She cut her captive's fingernails and toenails down to the quick, collecting them into a small plastic bag as carefully as evidence of a crime. Then Hurd unfolded the bed and ordered Rana Harter to lie down. She detached a small grooming unit from the cabin's valet drone, the sort of static electricity and vacuum brush that removes animal hairs from clothing. The commando paused, wondering if she should restrain the woman before proceeding. No. This next step would do as a test of the dopamine regulator's power over her captive. The hard plastic bristles of the groomer were ideal for defoliating skin. Hurd rubbed the device into Rana Harter's naked stomach in hard, sharp little motions, turning the epidermis there to a ruddy, anguished pink. The vacuum unit greedily consumed the dislocated cells, its fierce little whine drowning out the small, ambivalent noises that came from the woman's mouth as Hurd worked. Exhausting the skin of the stomach, Hurd moved on to her captive's small breasts, but the woman's movements proved too unruly. Hurd turned Rana Harter over and quarried the broad expanse of her back and dug hard into the thicker skin of her arms and legs. Soon she had enough, the vacuum's collector almost full. She tapped its precious cargo onto the table, carefully emptying the collector by wetting her smallest finger with saliva and probing the crannies of the vacuum's mechanism. Then Hurd doped the tube of petroleum jelly with the second needle from the medical station and squeezed it out onto the skin cells. The admixture moved and grew hot. Removing her own clothes, Hurd rubbed the petroleum jelly over her own flesh, skipping the flexor metal soles of her feet, the exposed hypercarbon of her knee and shoulder joints, and the metal weave of microwave array on her back. She was a commando, not an intelligence operative, and she would never look human while naked. But hopefully security at the polar base would be too overextended by the horde of new draftees for full physicals. Hurd's path here to the pole had been well disguised, and the Imperials were looking for a single infiltrator on an entire planet. Presumably, her identity would be confirmed by visual comparison with Rana Harter's records, gene-typing a few strands of hair and reading the genetic material from her human thermal plume. When activated, the nano-intelligence now incorporated into the petroleum jelly would slough Rana Harter's skin cells at a normal human rate, providing constant ambient evidence of her borrowed identity. If the security forces here demanded a retina scan or some quaint, ancient technique such as fingerprints or dental records, the commando would have to fight her way out in a hurry. As for the face, Alexander had searched the records of the entire Legis 15 military structure for a close match, also selecting for Harter's micro-astronomy expertise and vulnerability to drugs, and had intervened to transfer the woman here to the pole. Of course, the compound mind could have changed any electronic record to match Hurd's appearance, but human memory was beyond its reach. There was the possibility that someone at the polar station had actually met Rana Harter. The compound mind was being very cautious. Hurd was its only human asset on the planet, and might have to pass as the woman for several days, even weeks, while she prepared for the transmission. At least, the commando thought, she would no longer be alone. She would need to keep Rana Harter with her to restock her supply of skin cells. Hurd emptied her captive's kit bag on the floor and sorted through the contents. Most of the woman's civilian clothes wouldn't fit her larger frame, but the baggy militia fatigues covered her adequately. Hurd glanced at her timestamp. The hairpiece should be done by now. On the table, the hemisphere of plastic had stilled. She picked it up cautiously, but it had cooled to room temperature. With a quick, snapping motion, the commando turned it inside out, revealing Rana Harter's hair, now inset into the plastic. She lifted the hairpiece onto her shaved head, where it fit snugly, incorporating the medical station's exact measurements of her skull. Alexander caused the cabin's window to opaque and then mirror. The rich woman regarded herself. Hurd experienced a brief dislocation as Rana Harter seemed to stare back at her from the mirrored window, mimicking her movements. The wig worked perfectly. The nanos had even managed to reconstruct Rana Harter's haircut from the mass of hairs. The resemblance was eerie. The commando heard a stir from the bed. Her captive rose slowly, a confused look on Rana's face as she touched her own tender skin. The dreamy expression of dopamine overdose sharpened a little as she stood next to Hurd, comparing her own shaved, naked and raw figure to her impersonators. She spoke the crude words of her imperial dialect. "Not bad," Herd's translation software supplied. "But what about your eyes?" The Rixwoman looked in the reflection at her violet artificial eyes, then at her captive. Rana Harta's eyes were almond. Herd blinked. The woman's eyes sparkled with tears from the relentless abrading of her skin. No amount of drugs could suppress the reactions of the body to pain. The commando shuddered inside. Death, hers or another's, meant little to her, measured against the scope of the Rix compound gods. But she wanted nothing of torture. She turned to the woman, lifting her fingers to point at the woman's eyes, requesting words from her software. The woman backed away, fear defeating the dopamine to mar her beatific expression. She was talking again. "You're going to take my eyes, aren't you?" Herd grasped Rana Harta's wrist firmly but softly. "No," she said. She knew that word. The look of fear didn't leave the woman's face. Herd suspended her previous request, asked for new sentences. "Just eye drop dye," the Rix woman said. "The medical station will make it for me when we get closer." "Oh," the woman stopped trying to pull away. "Let's talk now, please," Herd said. "Talk?" Rana Harta repeated. A pause. New sentences delivered. "I need to learn your language. Better than this. Let us make..." The word was too long, full of slurred sounds.
"Conversation?"
"Yes. I want your conversation, Rana Harta." Executive officer. Kathery Hobbs reached her captain's cabin door at 1.88 hours. She took a moment outside to gather herself, wondering if she was getting old. A few years ago, a missed night of sleep had seemed routine. Now, she'd been awake a mere 14 hours, barely more than a day, but Hobbs felt her emotions beginning to fray, her mask of calm efficiency growing more brittle by the minute. She only hoped that her intellectual capacity wasn't suffering as well. This would be a disastrous time to start making tactical errors. It wasn't simply age, though. The last few days had been a roller coaster of adrenaline, fear, anguish, and relief. The whole crew had been through the ringer, and now they faced 10 days at high acceleration, followed by a battle in which they were overmatched. All of Hobbs's simulations put the Lynx's chances against the Rix battlecruiser at the raw edge of survivability. Hobbs doubted for a moment her purpose here at the captain's cabin. Was it just wild emotion that had brought her? Perhaps she should wait until after the battle with the Rix to confront this question. She could simply turn around and head for the command bridge, where the senior staff would be assembling in 12 minutes to present their detailed battle plans. But however confident she and the captain might act for the crew, they both knew that the Lynx would probably not survive the battle. If she didn't ask now, she might never know the answer. Hobbs watched her fingers requesting entry. That common gesture felt suddenly alien, as it had when she'd first left home to enter the Navy. When Kathry wanted a door to open on a utopian world, she'd just ask it. Air cars went where they were told, hand phones heard and obeyed. But the military never talked to their tools. Such anthropomorphism was too decadent for the Greys. Machines were machines. Here on the Lynx, opening a door required a gestural sequence, a tongue click, perhaps even a token of some kind. It was all secret handshakes and magic rings. The Greys preserved spoken language for use among humans, as if conversing with the ship would somehow bring it to life. In retaliation, Grey machines seldom talked to their masters. Instead, they employed a bewildering conglomeration of signifiers to get their messages across. Back on her utopian birth world, a burning house would simply alert its occupants with the words, "Excuse me, but I'm on fire." Navy alarms, however, were composed of unpleasant sounds and flashing lights. But Kathry had discovered that she had a gift for the codes and icons. Imperial interfaces had a curt efficiency that she enjoyed. Like a jetboard or a hang glider, they responded instantly to subtle motions. They weren't slowed down by politesse. And so the captain's answer came all too quickly. "Come," he said, his voice raw from lack of sleep. The door opened to reveal Zai. His tunic was unclasped, its metal ringlets hanging slack, his hair glistening from a recent shower. His eyes were lined with red. Hobbs was brought up for a moment by the sight of her captain in disarray. In their two subjective years together, she had never seen him at less than parade readiness.
"What is it, Hobbs?" he said. He ran his fingers through his hair and glanced at the tactical stylus in her hand. Captain Zai smiled. "Couldn't wait for the meeting to regale me?" Her eyes fell shyly as she took a step into the cabin. The door closed behind her.
"I'm sorry to disturb you, Captain."
"It's time, anyway. We can't be late for this briefing. Work your staff hard, work yourself harder, eh, Hobbs?"
"Yes, sir.
And make sure they notice," she completed the quote. He nodded and began to work the clasps of his heavy woolen uniform. Hobbs watched the fingers of his gloved artificial hand move momentarily, unable to speak. He pointed to his conference table. "Ever actually seen sand before?" The table was covered with a galaxy of bright, hard shapes. Hobbs leaned closer and picked one up. The tiny object was sharp in her hand, with the familiar facets of structured carbon.
"So, this is sand, sir."
Hobbs knew the battle specs on 10 different types of sand, but she'd never held the stuff between her fingers. "Yes, what poets and politicals call diamonds. I intend to use quite a bit of it in the battle, Hobbs. We can synthesize 100 tons or so in the next 2 weeks." She nodded. Sandcaster drones were used in any space engagement to spread confusion in the enemy's sensors, but at this battle's high relative velocity, the stuff could be lethal. At high speed, enough of the hard, sharp particles could eat away even hull alloy.
"Pretty little things, sir."
"Keep one, if you like." Hobbs put the diamond in her pocket, closed a fist on its hard shape. There was no delaying her purpose here any longer.
"I just had a question, sir, before the meeting."
"Certainly, Hobbs."
"To better understand your thinking, sir," she said. "You see, I'm not sure that I completely grasp your motivations."
"My motivations?" he said with surprise. "I'm a soldier, Hobbs. I have orders and objectives, not motivations."
"Generally true, sir," she admitted. "And I don't mean any personal intrusion, Captain. But the current tactical situation, as we both have agreed, seems to have become intertwined with your personal motivations, sir."
"What the devil are you asking, Hobbs?" Zai said, his fingers frozen on the top clasp of his uniform. Hobbs felt her face flush with embarrassment. She wished she could disappear or could rewind time and find herself on the other side of his door, walking toward the command bridge, having never come in. But even mortified as she was, the emotions that had carried her into the captain's cabin pushed her to say the next words.
"Captain, you know that I'm very happy that you rejected the blade. I did all I could to convince..." She swallowed. "But now that you have, I'm just a bit confused."
Zai blinked, then the slightest smile played at his lips. "You want to know why I didn't kill myself, eh, Hobbs?"
"I think it was the right choice, sir," she insisted quickly.
It was absolutely essential that he not misunderstand her.
"But as your executive officer, I need to know why, in case it has an effect on our working together, sir."
"My motivation," Zai repeated, nodding his head. "Perhaps you think I've become unhinged, executive officer."
"Not at all, sir. I think your choice was very sane."
"Thank you, Hobbs." Lawrence Zai thought for a moment, then sealed the top clasp of his uniform and said, "Sit down." She found herself falling into one of the deep chairs around his airscreen table. The effort of breaching the topic had exhausted her. Her legs were weak. She was glad as she sat down that he would speak now, that she could remain silent. "Hobbs, you've known me for 2 years, and you know the kind of man I am. I'm Vaden and grey as they come. So I understand that you're surprised by my recent decisions."
"Happily surprised, sir," she managed.
"But you suspect there may be more to it, eh? Some secret directive from the apparatus that explains all this?" She shook her head. That wasn't it at all. But Zai went on. "Well, it's simpler than that. More human." She blinked, waiting through the interminable pause. "After 40 relative years and almost a century of absolute time, I found out something unexpected," he began. "Tradition isn't everything for me, Hobbs. Perhaps it was on Dantu that I changed, that some part of the old Lawrence Zai died. Or perhaps when I was rescued and rebuilt, they didn't put me back together in the same way. However it happened, I've changed. Service to the Emperor is no longer my only goal." Zai absentmindedly attached his captain's bars to his shoulders, where they slid to